until the Vancouver municipal elections. Holy crap, we have broken into double digits. I am Matthew Naylor, and this is the Cambie Report live show. I am joined, as always, by Patrick Meehan and Ian Bushfield.
Thank you for doing our job for us.
Yes.
And I'm sorry, I can't hit record correctly.
It's okay, we all screw up. I do so many times. But before we begin, it is always important to acknowledge that this event is taking place on the traditional territories of the Musqueam, Tsleil-Waututh, and Squamish peoples. And we would like to acknowledge that and thank them for the use of this space.
So a huge thank you to everyone for coming out. This is incredible. We can't actually see you because they turned the house lights on so high.
Not the house lights.
I don't know how stages work.
This is very warm and very bright, and I can't see more than 4 feet in front of me.
That's okay. We know it's a full house because we were wandering around earlier. So thanks everyone who came out. This is incredible. This is our second live show. We're apparently going to do more of these because people started supporting us on Patreon.
Where can people support us on Patreon?
People can support us on Patreon at patreon.com/CambieReport. What was that, Ian?
Patreon.com/CambieReport.
Patrick?
Patreon.com/CambieReport.
Right, patreon.com/CambieReport. And by the way, to all our Patreon supporters so far, thank you so much. It actually means an incredible amount to us. It is like a very humbling experience to have people like contribute and show their appreciation through this. It's absolutely mind-boggling to me. So let me extend my personal thanks on behalf of myself and Ian and Patrick, because it's absolutely incredible.
And a huge shout out to the Belmont staff and the venue for hosting us. They gave us a $50 bar tab, so we've already blown through that. So we're right good for this.
Let's get to the news. It has been, you know, after a couple of weeks that were a little late on news, we got to do a little more in-depth canvassing of Burnaby, for example, and thank you to Gavlin, who is also here tonight. But this week has turned out to be an absolute bonanza, a gold rush, the motherload of news, beginning with...
Well, in sad news, Patrick Condon dropped out of the race for mayor. He was seeking the nomination for Cope's nomination. And Patrick Condon is a landscape architect out of the School of Landscape Architecture at UBC. He's also been talking about urban planning issues for a long time, and him dropping out for medical reasons is, I think, a real detraction from the conversation that we're going to have, because I think he would have been a very valuable voice. As I've said before, I don't agree with him on
most of his things.
But I think
he thought he was interesting.
Yeah, but he brings
and I was tempted.
He brings an interesting conversation point. I think that's going to be a loss for the mayoral race. On the bright side, it does simplify the mayoral race slightly.
It'll be interesting, though, to see if Cope does seek another mayoral nominee, because they were very... They put all their eggs in.
Well, and they have said that they've had a number of people reach out to them in the since Patrick Condon announced that he was stepping out. And so maybe they'll put a candidate forward. My understanding is that their process is sometime in mid-August. And so a little late in the game to be launching a brand new mayoral candidate. But, I mean, Cope can cope.
I mean, the million mayor race, though. The million mayor race continues apace. We have got still like an absolute cornucopia of candidates that are still contesting the mayor's chair.
While we're on sort of sad dropouts for health reasons, the other news we saw is that Ken Clement from the Vancouver School Board, he's not just not running next year, he's actually resigned from school board already. So the Vancouver School Board's down to 8 members. He's one of Vision Vancouver's long-serving trustees, one of the... Yep. You know, strong Indigenous trustees, I believe, as well.
Yeah, and I think people think it's oftentimes easy to be like a school board trustee or a city councilor. It's really not. And, you know, as Andrew Reimer and Ellen Woodsworth talked about in our last live show, you know, there's a lot of work that goes into it. And, you know,
and occasionally the provincial government just fires you.
Also true. There's a family toll that takes on when you take on public life, and you know a medical issue can easily sideline you and make you have to step aside, and it's sad to see that happen.
So thank you to Ken Clement. I personally remember voting for Ken Clement in 2008 when I ran for the electoral area A.
Oh right, you're the only politician at this floor.
Yeah, well, technically. I got a grand total of 66 votes, but
it's electoral district A. So what's the total there? Like 2,000?
Didn't the winner win with like 200 votes?
191, I think. So
That's a solid performance.
Yeah, you got triple your vote and you were good.
Yeah, that's an easy thing to do, but not to belabor a race from 2008. Let's belabor the Labor Council endorsements. Vancouver District Labor Council. Oh, I know. I'm sorry, but this is what you're getting all night. Vancouver District Labor Council has announced their endorsements, and well, Kennedy Stewart. I said he was the front runner last time.
This definitely reinforces that.
Yeah, VDLC has always been a very, I mean, they were originally more COPE-friendly, and now they've been very vision-friendly for the last few elections. And so I think the anticipation is whether they were going to go with Ian Campbell or Kennedy Stewart or maybe even Shauna Sylvester. But I think Sylvester's tried to position herself more centrist almost, like trying to appeal to everyone and therefore excite no one. But
that's one way to put it. but yeah, Kennedy Stewart getting the nomination, I think, definitely cements him as that front runner, like we said. But also, I think it really is a sign that his campaign is working hard. He did another release of his fundraising totals, and I think he's up to over $50,000 fundraised now, which is no small amount when you think about the maximum per contributor is $1,200.
One thing that I think is interesting is that he definitely seems to be positioning himself as more of a progressive candidate, like the progressive capital P, as in NDP, progressive candidate, because on his recent interview on CITR, he made a particular point of painting Ian Campbell as more of a federal liberal, and I quote that specifically.
You took some personal offense to that, didn't you?
Well, I mean, Why not? It's a good thing that people are federal liberals. It is a good thing that people are partisan. But like I think that it is important that, you know, we take a look at where he is positioning himself and what like section of the electorate he is trying to appeal to.
Well, and I also wonder with Patrick Condon being out of the race, if Kennedy Stewart's not going to seek some of that voter block, because that is a sizable, you know, that left developer skeptical.
Well, and to go back to Ian Campbell really quickly too, is I think Vision has been this sort of amalgam of sort of center left liberals and NDPers for the last, you know, since its formation. And Ian Campbell definitely comes out of that sort of Fed Lib wing of that party. And so it's not altogether surprising that they went with Kennedy Stewart, but it is still also surprising because independents don't normally win. The last, as Justin McElroy says repeatedly on Twitter, the last independent to win a city council race in Vancouver was 1988, and that was Carol Taylor. And so we'll see, but good luck to being an independent candidate.
It also sounded like it wasn't too tough of a choice for the VDLC.
They debated for 15 minutes.
Yeah, Francis Buello was tweeting out that, you know, they had, the way the system works is the VDLC represents multiple unions around Vancouver and district, which is North Van, East. I don't know all of the ones.
I'm not sure how they draw the line between Vancouver District Labor and New West District Labor.
But like,
Labor,
yeah, New West has Burnaby, so I think it's cities that let's.
It's the Vancouvers. It's the Vancouvers. Let's just go
people
with
will
that
correct
one.
Us on Twitter later.
Richmond, I think.
So they had each of the candidates come and speak to representatives there, like 5 or 10 labor representatives, and do a little presentation. It wasn't a debate.
It's an interview, right? And the idea is that VDLC is going to want to say, you know, like, where do you stand on labor issues? Where do you stand on, in particular, contracting out, as it's called? The city has been not contracting out for the entire time that the Vision has been in power, which means that they have a policy of keeping work within the union rather than creating new things and bringing in private sector jobs. And so, you know, prospective NPA government, for example, or the last NPA government, heavily contracted out, and that's a big deal for VDLC because they want their union members to get union jobs, as they would call it.
Yes, and that also does tend to increase the cost of contracts, which is the argument
in favor of
doing that. Do you? I mean, like, it's an argument to be had, and one that will continue to be had forever.
Well, so, and one we're probably both going to have on our respective provincial politics podcasts
exactly.
When we start talking about the BC government's new moves. But so, let's talk about VDLC's council mm-hmm. and school board and park board nominations
and that's
or endorsements.
And that's where I think a lot of the interviewing comes in. So what we saw was both one city candidates, Brandon Yan and Christine Boyle, were endorsed by VDLC. That's not altogether surprising. I think that was sort of what I would expect.
They're also both amazing, personally.
Vision had Diego Cardona, Heather Deal, Tanya Paz, and
Wei Zhang.
We're all endorsed by VDLC. That's, again, all not altogether that surprising. I think Wei Zhang getting the endorsement is a good sign because he's definitely sort of the low end of that publicly known name. So it's
definitely it's a good
for
sign
him.
For Vision.
Well, it's good for him, I mean, personally.
Well, yeah, because Zhang beat out Catherine Evans, who's a sitting park board trustee.
And then both Adrian Carr and Pete Fry got the nomination endorsement for the Green Party. But notably, Michael Wiebe did not, nor did the other Green Party candidate, David Wong.
Now, this is important because the Green Party went through a kind of members' rebellion recently, where the negotiators for the VDLC, compact between the different parties. The Green Party negotiators agreed to a certain amount of candidates, and then the Green Party membership said, absolutely not. We're going to nominate as many council candidates and as many school board candidates as we damn well please.
They changed the nature of the agreement. I saw that in Empire Strikes Back. It's a normal strategy.
The spirit, though, stayed the same according to the Greens' press releases.
But notable with Michael Wiebe, I would say, I'm not surprised. I didn't expect Michael Wiebe would get the endorsement from VDLC generally. Maybe it was an interview thing, but Michael Wiebe is the owner of a restaurant. And full disclosure, it's 8 and a half at 8th and Main, and I go there basically every Sunday for brunch. But 8 and a half, as a bar owner, labor unions have long took issues with bars and restaurants for their labor practices, not necessarily being good or bad, but being non-unionized. And I think that it's very difficult if you are an owner of a shop that is not unionized to get a nomination from a union shop.
It was interesting. Like, there was a chance that VDLC could have just not endorsed anyone from the Greens, but then the Greens would have potentially just done a scorched earth type campaign. And, this is already fun enough.
As the Green Party is well known for doing, that's what I think of when I think of the Green Party, scorched earth.
And then lastly, no surprise, both Derek O'Keefe and Gene Swanson got endorsements from the VDLC. That's, VDLC endorsed Gene Swanson when she ran for mayor in 1988. Derek O'Keefe is a well-known local labor rights guy.
And also the Pope is Catholic.
Yeah.
Well, but VDLC didn't endorse Anne Roberts, who I think was seen
was a former counselor, too, wasn't
she? She was seen as potentially Cope's win over Derek O'Keefe. Like, I know Derek, and I like him, and he actually wished he could be here if he didn't have young children and a busy campaign, but for them to choose Derek over Anne was interesting. I don't really know what led to that.
Maybe that's going to be the interview process. Maybe that's going to be a proven track record that each of them have. It's hard to know because, again, these are, behind closed doors endorsements. Not saying that it's a bad thing, but...
I think it is good that there are these endorsements. Like, people should be able to have heuristic shortcuts in order to, look and say, my views align with, broadly, the concept of labor in an organized sense. And
oh my God, that's the most federal liberal way you could possibly describe unions.
and I wanted to vote with them. Or my views align with commerce in a chamber sense, to absolutely mangle the point, or the Georgia Strait, will be releasing its slate, presumably, eventually.
I think the only other thing I wanted to mention on the VDLC is on school board, they didn't endorse either Alan Wong, who's a sitting trustee for Vision, mm-hmm. or Diana Day, who Cope has been really championing, and she actually ran in the by-election really hard on Indigenous issues, on being feminist, and just trying to raise those profiles. And they did endorse another Cope candidate, Barb Parrott, I believe, for school board. And it's just not clear why they chose Barb over Diana.
Yeah, this kind of thing would be nice if there was a write-up. Not even necessarily a write-up of why they didn't endorse somebody, but a write-up of why they did.
Yeah.
But anyways, speaking of slates and parties.
If the VDLC feels like releasing that information at some point, that would be good. But
I think we kind of burned bridges with the VDLC when we
maybe
said vision
when
walked
we
away
revealed
from there.
The truth.
But yeah, so speaking of political parties and making decisions and various things, there is a new political party in Vancouver that has...
Yes, there is.
Oh, God. It's still a stupid name.
All the names are stupid.
They are all
there
stupid,
he is.
To be fair.
So, yes, Hector Bremner...
The worst kept secret in Vancouver.
Yes, the worst kept secret in Vancouver is indeed out on the cover of the Georgia Strait. We have a new political party. Yes, Vancouver is off to the races. Their candidates will be selected in a nomination vote on July 28th. And I am personally very interested in seeing who they are going to be putting forward for council, school board, and park board. It is an interesting thing because I have never seen a party launch so quickly and so close to an election and get... like the amount of publicity that Yes Vancouver has gotten, which I think is an interesting and bodes well for the movement that they've got going.
Well, and it's worth noting that Wei Young's Coalition Vancouver, I learned literally this morning, is also seeking to run candidates for council, school board, and park board.
I learned this just now.
They're trying to also build a party in the same amount of time.
Can
but
we have
doing...
a moratorium on new parties, please?
No.
This is extensive.
Let's ask David Chen in Pro Vancouver about that as well.
By the way, here are some other names. Vancouver United, the Coalition of Vancouver Elect.
Vancouver First.
Isn't Vancouver United a soccer team, I'm sure? Somewhere?
It's also a church.
That's never been a problem before.
Oh, fair. But I will say, if you're interested in getting involved and you think that Yes Vancouver has sort of a message that reverberates with you, join the party, go to the nomination, seek an attempt to get involved and volunteer for them, as you should with any political party. I think one of the things that somebody told me last night when I was at an event was that democracy doesn't happen in the polling booth. It happens in our civil society all the time. It happens in the organizations that we join, the organizations that we take part in. And I think it's really valuable to take part in that process and join a political party and be involved and see how the machines of democracy operate.
Or if you don't like Yes Vancouver, join any number of other parties.
It turns out there's a political party for everybody.
I know that at our last live show, people got signed up for Vision Vancouver. So these kind of things
really?
Happen. Yes, that happened. I'm not going to name names.
Oh, I think I know.
Was it Tanya Pass? It was Tanya Pass. I'm almost certain.
Well, she was already a member of Vision, but yeah, she was signing people up.
She was signing people up.
I hope she joined
sooner
than
that. Good campaigning. It is great that candidates are here, and we will be, of course, talking to them a little later for everyone in the audience. But speaking of candidates, a new poll by Mario Canseco's Research Co. is out. And
there's
who
so
wants
much
to, give us
to
a,
read about it.
Yeah, who wants to give us a rundown of the numbers?
26 and 25% were each given to Ken Sim and Kennedy Stewart. 20% for Ian Campbell. 11% for Shauna Sylvester, which is, I think, low for her campaign. Wei Young clocked in at 8%, which I think is what I estimated she would probably get. And Hector Bremner came in at 5%. And then David Chen at 4%.
Now, it should be noted that this poll was in the field last week.
Sometime in the last week.
It's a very recent poll. So if I'm Ken Sim and the NPA, I'm pretty happy with this poll. Like, it shows that the name recognition of the party is still strong and that all of the internecine battles and the frankly very odd public statements of the president of the party have not significantly harmed them in ways that make it so they can't win.
I challenge that. I actually think that the 26% could easily have been...
Coming in first is bad?
Oh, yeah. No, absolutely. Like, 26% and within the margin of error of, like, third place is actually a fucking terrible result for Ken Sim, especially since he appears to have, like, completely disappeared off the public stage. 26% plus the ostensible 5 and 8% that other NPA-affiliated or formerly affiliated candidates...
Potential voters, yeah. Essentially.
But, like, both Bremner and Young both submitted some kind or expressed interest in the NPA nomination, and that could mean that an NPA nominee would be polling in the high 30s, which would have been
Like their ceiling. Like if like, because Ken Sim's not going to steal votes from, you know, Kennedy Stewart voters, for example, so that the ceiling of Ken Sim is actually quite low, is what you're saying.
Yeah, the ceiling is low, and those votes are parked. Like the people who have abandoned the NPA have abandoned the NPA, and they have gone to either Bremner or to Young, or one of the other candidates, maybe Shauna Sylvester. But the people who are still with the NPA have to be convinced, and they have to be held, and they have to be turned out. And 26 is an incredibly small margin of error to be working with, especially when your next largest competitor is 25.
I think you might be drawing more conclusions than are valid here. I think coming in first is good.
it's not bad.
Yeah. But it's
not great.
I think if I'm Kennedy Stewart's campaign, I'm really happy with 25%. If I'm Ian Campbell's campaign, I'm pretty okay at 20% because they've got a machine. They've got the voter rolls. They can make it work. Shauna Sylvester, I would be a little concerned on her campaign at 11%. I think you're coming in low at that point. You've got a real work to do. And, you know, for Wai Young, I think 8% is what she's... I think that's her ceiling.
Wai Young is running a turnout-based operation, counting on the fact that her closed system of voters is going to be able to motivate people to turn out to the polls at a much higher rate than some of her competitors and carry her to victory that way.
And I'm gonna fully say it's a little awkward that he's in the room right now, but Hector Bremner being at 5%, you know, if I was his campaign... or him, I would be a little nervous about that number, but I don't think it's that much to worry about because he hasn't really gotten in the field yet.
Well, and the full focus of the Yes Vancouver campaign right now is that internal stuff. They're not looking outwards. They're trying to build the organization. Mm-hmm. They just appointed a board. They're trying to figure out what they are, what they stand for, and then they go and campaign. Of course, when you also have Kennedy Stewart, Ken Sim, and Ian Campbell, and Shauna Sylvester already campaigning, you're sort of starting 200 meters back on a 100-meter race. But
everyone else is out running, and you're just getting into the race. But I do think that there is a lot of space for them to come in, and I think that this would be concerning, but I don't think it's something to start lighting fires over.
Well, and just with the numbers, you look at it, and someone can be mayor with 26% of the vote,
which
is problematic in my view, but that's how Vancouver works.
It's the best advertisement for that proportional representation referendum that's starting 2 days after.
Proportional representation for a single seat does not mean... It's still...
Okay, some form of not first past the post.
You can have a rank ballot.
Just not first past the post.
Like every party uses for their leadership. Anyway,
yeah. My thoughts on the Yes Vancouver thing is I would be a little trepidatious about that 5%. I would be pleased that the number and the name recognition has increased over the last poll that Research Co. came out with.
You were saying they doubled their vote.
Yeah,
because didn't Hector come in at 2% in the last poll?
It was. So, yes, 250% increase. That's nothing to sneeze
that's
at.
That's the most improved player award. Exponential. You can't draw a trend from 2 points. Sorry.
People do all the time.
There are actually
they shouldn't, but they do.
There are statistical ways to draw trends from 1 point. Not the subject. Yes, there are. It's not the subject of this
Burnaby.
Podcast, though. As a final point, I would wait for the next poll because being on the cover of the Georgia Street and having your face plastered around Vancouver is going to improve name recognition, and it is going to put the Yes Vancouver message of, you know, and we'll get to this when we talk about Ian Campbell's tweet, but there is a... message that I think is not represented among the other candidates, and I think it is worthwhile to look at.
And he's the only mayoral candidate to show up to one of our live shows, and that's got to help you somehow.
Important Canby report bump.
Burnaby.
So moving to Burnaby. We had it's fascinating to me that Vancouver is having its weirdest election that it's had in decades, and...
Turns out weirdness is contagious.
Well, everyone else is too.
So I want to draw... I wasn't here for the last podcast, and I'm actually moving to Burnaby potentially before the election, which means I probably should have been there to learn more, but it was a great episode, despite the few people who may have downloaded it at double speed. But...
Sorry. that is my fault and my fault alone.
So Kelvin's in the room, but he had a new story that came out, and I know it wasn't inspired by the fact we covered Burnaby... And then talked about how that Derek Corrigan is facing some political heat for Dem evictions and all that, but he seems to have rapidly changed course after we released our last episode.
Yeah, I mean, it's there's been movements in that direction amongst his council members where they did move things out to public hearings and such. But it is fascinating. So what's happened today is, what happened in the last provincial election was that the NDP had in their campaign platform that they would allow municipalities to rent for zoning, to zone for rental only. And that means that areas of the city could be zoned so that you could only build rental properties on them. And this is something I really strongly supported at the time. And it came in, it was in the throne speech. This February, and it was moved in legislation this spring, and has gained royal assent about 2 months ago. And according to the news story that Kelvin put out, and quotes from city councilors, they just discovered they can do this and weren't aware that this had been a process for the last year.
So it hasn't been for the last year. So the NDP brought in legislation this spring, and it passed royal assent, just I think, months ago.
The comment from the city councilor was something like, I just discovered we can do this. Yeah.
So Derek Corrigan and his party have executed a triple axel with the skill of Tonya Harding and is going to be attempting to take a crowbar to the insurgent candidacy of...
To finish the thought on this zoning thing. So no municipality currently has a plan for exercising this rental zoning. And, you know, Justin McElroy had an article out a couple of weeks ago that talked about how he asked around and nobody had a plan yet. Burnaby's going to be the first one out of the gate to do it, which everyone would have assumed they would be the last ones.
Speaking of which, and Dem evictions, by the way, are a process where rental housing is demolished in order to make way for stratified single ownership condominiums.
And the big controversy is all around Metrotown, where Burnaby has a massive plan to essentially tear down Metrotown Mall and build a Yale town of Burnaby, is what it looks like. Like, it looks pretty, but it's going to be all rich people, and they're starting with the affordable rental buildings rather than the houses.
And apparently there is going to be a guarantee for the people who are displaced that rental housing will be available.
That's the new thing, is this guarantee that there's going to be rental-only zoning. And I think that's a really positive thing to be able to ensure affordability in a region. And Burnaby being the first out of the gate is going to really hold a lot of rental in place if they do it. And I'm excited to see where it goes.
I think, it doesn't hold a lot of rental in place. It demolishes a lot of rental, but it makes other rental elsewhere. Like, it's actually extremely bothersome to me because...
No, that's not true. If you take an area that's got a bunch of mid-rise rental right now, like Burnaby has, and you zone it for only rental, it takes the profit incentive out of bulldozing it so that you can keep running it as rental. And yes, you could upzone it and build more rental, but the value proposition isn't necessarily there. So it does lock in those buildings for a longer term.
So is Burnaby going to be rescinding their demolition permits for the already approved condos?
Yes. That's actually in the news article that came out today from Kelvin. Two of them have been pushed back. But that being said, there's still a lot of low mid-rise rental in that area. And if Burnaby moves to protect it in that way, I think that's going to be really positive for the region.
But it's hard to know how this will actually affect the Burnaby election, because Burnaby's been run by Corrigan for so long, but it's been this like festering and growing anger.
Yeah, it is a real sign that the Corrigan camp really know Burnaby. They've won a lot of elections. They understand where people are at. And if they're doing a 180 on this, that's because they're scared. That's because they're worried about losing the next election. And, you know, this is going to be Corrigan's fight for his life.
Well, one of the reasons for that is Mike Hurley, who you guys talked about before. He's the former fire chief who earned the New Weston District Labor Council endorsement. He actually got the endorsement of Joe Keithley, the guy who is going to run for the Green Party mayoral, Burnaby Greens mayoral. And he said...
Is Joe Keithley what he normally goes by?
Yes, that is what he normally goes by now.
He used to go by Joey Shithead.
Back in the 80s, he had a bit of a different moniker. but yeah, this is a real sign, I think, that this is a real race. We're all hoping that Mario Canseco gets a poll into the field in Burnaby so we can actually have some sense of it. There was a really fun Twitter conversation that I was part of where like everyone in media was asking Mario to run a poll in Burnaby, and it'd be really nice to see, just so we get a sense
of
where it's
at. It'd be much nicer for Mario to do it spontaneously than for us to have to crowdfund from you to do it, because we will do that, but
we will try.
We'll try. And if we don't, we'll just spend it on beer.
Yep.
But let's move
or gin.
Let's move from Burnaby.
Yes. We're going to
along the expo line, you might say.
Yeah, we're going to skip a couple stations though, because we don't have any information on New Westminster politics at the moment.
Other than the New Westminster politicians
in the
room.
Information will be coming later, obviously. But
next
Surrey,
slide showing New Westminster.
Surrey has avoided a carpetbagger candidacy by former Deputy Premier Rich Coleman. Why could this be?
I wonder why Rich Coleman decided now was a bad time to run for an election.
Well, he didn't give a reason, and I think I saw someone ask his campaign.
He spent a lot more time
manager.
With family, I'm sure.
No. He said he wanted to devote himself to the important work of opposition.
Yeah.
But interestingly, coming out of the woodwork is former mayor of Surrey for a very long time, Doug McCallum.
So you lived in Surrey. Were you in Surrey when he was mayor?
I lived in Surrey when he was mayor, and his brother was the elementary school principal.
Oh, God. Small town story.
Yeah. Vancouver is like the biggest small town and the small townest big city in the world.
So Doug McCallum famously held the line on property taxes for almost his entire run. They didn't increase property taxes once, even with inflation. And so the city saw city resources, city recreation centers, and policing significantly reduced over the run of his tenure as mayor. And when he left, he was very hated. It's interesting to see him come back. No, I'm serious. I was going door to door for a political party back then.
Nostalgia is a powerful force.
A candidate for which is actually in the room right now. But I was going door to door for a political party in Surrey when he lost his election. And I had people answer the door and I'd say, we would love it if you voted for this lefty party that has no hope. And they I had one woman that look at me and say, I will never tell anyone how I voted, but I will tell you I didn't vote for that crook. And then I was like, oh, okay. And she says, I mean Doug McCallum. And I'm like, I got that. Okay.
This sounds delightful. I used to canvass for the federal Liberals in Calgary, Alberta. So,
hey, they won 2 seats there in the last election.
They did.
Yeah. And then those guys didn't turn out great.
Yeah.
And they're going to lose.
So Doug McCallum coming back is really fascinating to me. It means that, anybody can, I guess, rebuild a political career. But
will they rebuild Surrey's transit infrastructure? Will they make it effective?
So Doug McCallum has said that he would immediately seek to scrap the L line, as it's colloquially referred to, which is the line that would run from Guildford to Surrey Central and down to Newton, which is the light rail line that they're going to build.
Does L line stand for line?
It looks like an upside down L on the map.
That's too bad. I thought it was like D-Day or H-Hour.
No, it's dumber.
What is it? Chicago, the L line stands for elevated? One of those cities?
Ooh, yeah. That's a good one.
What
Doug McCallum wants to do is he wants to take all of the money saved from that and throw it into extending the Expo line down to Langley instead of building an LRT to Langley, which is an ongoing conversation in Surrey, is this LRT versus SkyTrain debate, which I get really frustrated by because I find technology debates about transit to be really stupid, and I would like to leave that with urban planners and transportation planners rather than the electorate.
Well, but an alternate option...
Okay. Oh, this is the weirdest laugh line in the history of this podcast.
That is. I love you guys. That's amazing.
We have too many urban planners in our audience, or not enough.
There are not enough urban planners involved in urban planning.
But
this
you know
is
what?
Too many
regular people.
No, it's literally too many politicians and not enough urban planners. There is an education and an important set of principles that go into transit planning. And the fact that we have, outsourced transit planning, and MLAs for the North Shore have decided to write up a bunch of, SkyTrain for the North Shore stations without input from the Metro Vancouver Transit Planning Board.
There are, three people in this room so happy right now.
Well, but just to close off our first half of the show, the other thing that's happening in Surrey is the Left Party thinks...
Proudly Surrey.
Who are proudly Surrey, because... This goes back to our terrible names of political parties.
The Proud Boys reference is really weird that the lefty party is running with Proudly Surrey.
But no names mean anything.
But I also think there is some really positive element to the idea that Surrey has a political party that wants to be proud of being Surrey. And I think coming from Surrey, we had a long tradition of not respecting our own city and not being proud of where we came from because everyone told us we were garbage. And I think it's really cool that transition has occurred in the city to a point where a political party thinks it can gain value from that, from being proud of being Surrey.
Well, that may be good.
Even if they have stupid positions on
their position on transit is to just get Surrey out of TransLink despite the success.
Okay.
I'm not from here, but Matthew's got a rant first.
Can I give context first before you rant?
Okay.
Can I context
rant,
before?
Rant, you? Context, pulling out of the
It's
hair.
Important to not give context before the rant.
No, go.
Okay, so what they want to do is they want to create a South of the Fraser Transportation Authority with presumably Delta, Surrey, Langley, and potentially, well, both Langleys, and potentially, I guess, maybe Richmond, probably not. And so they would create this South Fraser Transportation Authority. It would gain the taxation money that normally goes, that currently goes to TransLink, and it would oversee operations in the South of Fraser. This is obviously a really bad idea, but they...
There's nothing like having a train that is operated by one agency, and then it crosses a river,
yeah,
and then it's operated by another.
You can work through. You can work through.
West Vancouver Blue Bus Company.
Right before Matthew launches into the rant that I'm going to very much agree with, the fact is that Surrey receives very much more transit outlay of service and road maintenance by TransLink than Surrey submits in farebox revenue and taxation. And so the idea that they would be better served with their own transportation authority is weird because it would be less money than they're getting now.
Two things. One, the ancillary rant that I have about fare gates is going to be postponed to a later date.
Oh, thank God.
And I will probably agree with that one, but...
I have such a rant on that one. But we are one region. It is one integrated system of people and goods movement that must be considered as one united whole. It is absolutely insane that a party would think that they could separate their city, the second largest in the region, from any kind of integrated planning. It makes no sense. TransLink plans for the movement of goods and people around the city. One city, not the party, but the region, has like a set of needs that cannot be considered as separate parcels. There must be a unified plan. It is unthinkable and frankly irresponsible for proudly Surrey to be saying something like, we need to take Surrey out of TransLink. And if they wanted to do so, run for the provincial government. You know, that is where that would be amended.
Hey, Matthew, did you know that we had a Reddit complaint that we were too wonky?
We had two.
I did not even mention the name of the act, the South Coast Regional Transportation Board Act. Like, I swear to God, so, this is not wonky.
Okay.
It is important. We have...
Let me not, without defending the idea, try to understand it. So on the left, you often see the ideas of local democracy and local coordination, more direct democracy. And so TransLink gets a lot of flack for being bureaucrats that no one knows working sort of two arm's lengths from anything you get to vote for, and that feels like they're not actually giving two shits about what voters care about.
TransLink gets way too many shits that they do not deserve. TransLink is one of the most effective and important and well-run transit systems in the entire fucking world. Well done to anyone who works at TransLink. Thank you so much for your hard work, and keep it up!
Oh, I wasn't going to disagree. What I was going to say is, like, the let's get a city out of TransLink move is almost a like Brexit move for Britain. Well, and it's the same kind of idea. It's like there's a certain like the European Union
bus pass per month.
The European Union can be seen by leftists and the far right in Britain as being too disconnected from voters there because it was set up as a very autocratic, like the government just appoints people to it. And there wasn't a very direct, and it's been moving towards a more direct democracy with the European Parliament. But the problem is
a representative democracy, not a direct democracy,
Which
is a
right.
monstrosity. Yeah. By the way, is
Thanks
a Surrey exit a sexit?
Ooh. But so I can,
it's not
like
actually
I'm
funny.
Not in favor of any of the municipalities pulling out of TransLink, to be clear. So I can kind of maybe understand why, but I don't agree.
Well, I think the South of the Fraser feels like they haven't received the attention that the other areas have. And when you look at it, you know, the Evergreen line went in, the Millennium line went in, the Canada line went in.
Talking about a Broadway line.
Yeah, we're talking about a Broadway line. And I think it's funny that you know, this would come out in the same year that we're going to build like some major light rail in South of Fraser. And, you know, people ignore the bus expansion that's occurred south of the Fraser. But I do understand the feeling of like, everyone else has gotten a rail line. Why are we last? And we're always last.
And we're getting a light rail line that feels like half a line.
Well,
even though they're getting three times as much.
Yeah,
line.
Okay, let's not delve into that one.
But the fact
that I get the perspective. I just disagree with it.
The fact that like our regional transit system is underbuilt is not TransLink's fault. It is the provincial and federal government's fault, and the fault of municipal politicians who won't.
It's too bad the province didn't do anything for a while.
Won't raise property taxes or alternatively don't have the taxation powers that many U.S. cities do that would allow them to raise the funds necessary to build such essential transit infrastructure. Last time I checked, it was still 93 days until the Vancouver, Surrey, Burnaby, New Westminster, Belcarra, and more.
I mean, in like Richmond, 3 hours, it's going to be 92 days.
Et cetera. And elections.
And I will say, courtesy of Justin McElroy's Twitter, that one more mayor is not running for re-election. The mayor of Bowen Island is not running for re-election.
Bowen Island. Oh, no. All right. Well, turnover continues apace, but we have a little bit of turnover. Our next segment has some fucking fantastic guests that I feel absolutely privileged to be sitting right next to. But I'm going to turn this over to my glorious co-host to introduce them, Ian.
All right. So we're joined by two guests who both co-edit the Fantastic Price Tags blog, which they are going to... I'm sorry, it shouldn't be called blog. It should be called online magazine. All right. And they asked me to plug that. They asked us to plug that at least, you know, once tonight, but I think we will plug it a couple times.
We'll manage
Price Tags.
It's really quite something that Price Tags is an absolutely priceless resource for the region.
But I just want to make sure...
I'm so awful. I'm so sorry.
But before I do the introduction, Price Tags is named after you, right? Yes. So sitting beside me here is Gordon Price, the director of the city program at Simon Fraser University.
Well, I was.
Not quite.
He was. Oh, I picked up the wrong bio for you.
You're about a year out of date, I think.
Ah, but you were a past city councilor here in Vancouver for nonpartisan association.
86 to 2002.
And you served on the board for the Greater Vancouver Regional Municipal, the Greater Vancouver Regional District of Metro Vancouver.
That's when we used to call it that, GVRD.
And you were appointed to the first board of the Greater Vancouver Transport Authority, which is now called TransLink.
Exactly right.
And cheers! You run the website Price Tags.
You know, I absolutely agree with Ian, but I'm thinking I'm going to support that proposal anyway, so we can call it Sexit. Yeah. That is too good.
Oh, no.
And we're also joined here by Sandy James. Sandy is a city planner and editor at Price Tags. She's the director of... She was or is the director of Walk Metro Van. And the director of Walk Metro Van. And was the Greenways director for the City of Vancouver, as well as the chair of the Walk 21 conference in 2011. And has written extensively on Vancouver, including a upcoming book called Walking, Connecting Health with Sustainable Transportation. And I believe you also walk approximately 50 kilometers a week.
Yeah, 30 miles. That's about right.
30 miles a week. Yeah. There you go.
So a big hand to Sandy James and Gordon Price.
And I will say, Price Tags has been a blog that I've been following for many, many years. I think a lot of people like me that came up in the urbanist style community in Vancouver, that now includes people like Nathan Bahal, who is a city councilor out in Langley, or Brandon Yan, who's running for One City in Vancouver, and a number of others, all sort of found Price Tags a number of years ago when we were getting interested in city issues and when we were looking for sort of what was going on in Vancouver. And it was, at the time, the only real hub of information that we could get access to. And today, there's other sources, but but Price Tag still remains on my like number one follow list because all the information is always accurate. It's always data driven. It's always evidence based, and there's always something there about what's going on in Vancouver that is valuable to read. And I think it's Price Tag is a huge ad for the community.
Well, and on that, Sandy, you were telling me before you were very focused on facts as one of the editors for it. Can you just sort of expand on your focus and why that's so important when talking about municipal issues rather than...
Well, I think, firstly, thank you, and thank you, everybody, for coming out. I think, and also thank you for everyone that's running for council. And for these three, I've never laughed so much, but also how important it is to be involved municipally. This is really where the incubator of policy happens. It's the city level. So thank you for coming out, and thank you to everybody that's running, and best of luck. But moving back to Price Tags, I think one of the nicest things anyone has ever said to me, and I've shared it with Gordon, is they call Price Tags badass. And so, of course, you know, if someone says that on Twitter, you say, well, what do you mean by badass? And they say, because you get it right, you're not scared of saying the truth, and you make sure it's fact-based. And so I think part of what Gordon has started, and when I was working at City Hall, and I had 20 emails to answer, or 20 emails that would have come in the night before, the first thing I always did was read Price Tags at 8:30 and then start the day. I think it's really important to have accurate, fact-based information and to ensure that you're always coming from a place that's leaving the reader with something more. So it's not just about what you've heard in the paper, but what the background is, what the policy is, what other people have said about it and where it's happened elsewhere. And also, we have, we're one of the few blogs that allows commenters, and the comment people are badass.
It is extensive comments. It's something that I go to regularly to check to see what the conversation is. It's a really valuable resource.
It is like one of the few comment section on the internet that is not the cesspool of misery and destruction that seems to have pervaded everything since mid-2014. So... thank you for running such an invaluable resource. It's just incredible.
Well, we're trying to take it to the next level now. We did get an angel who did give us some money, and now we are going to actually, we all have our own Patreon site too, because we would like to broaden out the base of Price Tags to cover more of the region and to cover a greater diversity of urban issues. Neighborhood near you.
What's the URL for that? Is it pricetags.com?
I think to be determined at this point.
Yeah, to be determined. In fact, there will be announcements to come shortly.
All right. Very excited. Well, maybe we'll splice that in.
Please, thank you.
So Gordon, you spent several terms on council. Five or six,
I lost count.
Yes.
Six, according to the notes I have in front of me.
In the era that you were on council, you were with the NPA at that time, and my understanding is you guys built a lot of bike lanes.
Well, now, bike lanes. Boy, you can't have a conversation without that coming up. It was such a minor issue at the time. I look back on it as a kind of golden age. Really, the direction that we had at that point because of the opportunity with the mega projects, perhaps people have forgotten, but there was, again, lost count, 7 or 8 mega projects on the scale of Cole Harbour, Concord, Fraser Lands, Joyce.
Yale Town.
Oh, my gosh. So we could absorb a huge amount of growth, never have to go into the existing neighborhoods of the city. We had a plan happening with that too, city plan. Again, a good foundation. But I look back upon that and I realize that we were really able to find a very unusual balance of accommodating growth while at the same time allowing the neighborhoods to maintain their character and stability. And I don't think any of us realized that that was going to be a brief period as it's turned out to be.
Do you feel at all that we have lost the will to build or innovate? Because, like, to me, it seems like it's so hard to get stuff pushed through nowadays. Like, Chicago managed to build its sewer system by raising the entire city up 2 meters in a year. And that was in 1890-something or other, 1890. And now, like, to do such a thing seems almost unthinkable. Why can't we get this kind of mega project through anymore? Why can't we build housing on the same scale that we did during your time in council?
We do, and people don't talk about it.
Well, that is not the answer.
I think that's true. That's a good point.
Yeah. Did you know that New Westminster was building 1,000 units of rental just this year?
So,
I feel like New Westminster has kind of taken over our live show today.
Yeah, something.
We will talk about you soon, we promise.
Yay! quiz time. What's the first priority of local government?
Garbage collection.
Nope.
Yeah, that was also what I was going to say.
I mean, that's the default thought, but...
Listening? Is that where we're going?
I mean, like, define local government. Is Metrovan local government? Because
yes.
Keeping potholes out of the roads is probably... Like, moving people around the region is what I would say.
Municipal and regional government. Okay, I'll go right to it. Water. No water.
I was going
to
say beer.
No water, no city.
You held up your glass. People who are listening later can't see what you're doing.
It's all about water. Water in, water out. Water that won't kill you, and water that when we make it dirty, we clean up. It is absolutely essential. No city starts without it. No city can survive without it.
Right, that's
and
sewer
we
that I just
do a great job of water, and we never have to talk about it. But there is a glass tower full of engineers who's a responsibility for water. Water is really what the first job of local government is about. You add in the other thing we don't have to talk about a lot, and that's emergency services, fire, police. That's it. That's most of what local government does. That's its budget. You are not going to have a discussion about that because you don't have to. It's so well run in this region, we can take it for granted, goddammit, and thank God we can. And then we can get
a plause line for that.
Yeah, then well, that's sort of the TransLink conversation that we had is that we take how good TransLink is
absolutely.
For granted.
That's right. And we concentrate on the deficiency. If and that's legitimate too. But
I'm going to say if my water was deficient, I would be dead.
Very unhappy. But when you say, Ian, that we can't do that, we're doing it all the time. The city of Vancouver has a 1% strategy in terms of turning over all that basic infrastructure. We do it without anyone hardly noticing. A little bit of discomfort sometimes here or there. But certainly not even in defense. It's something that because we have been so good at it for so long, because we can take it for granted, we shouldn't dismiss it or forget about it.
I think that's fascinating because I think about the article that came out recently, just I think yesterday from, I think it was Star Metro, about the amount of wastewater that goes into False Creek. And they talked about how we're changing over 6 kilometers of water line every year to get to a point where we're no longer going to do that.
Yeah, there's a good example of the deficiency. There is a problem there, and we will address it. But for anyone who was brought up in the city, to remember what False Creek was like, it was an industrial sewer. Nothing lived in it.
There were proposals to fill it in.
Yeah,
it was
absolutely,
so
in the 50s. Mm-hmm. And we've cleaned it up more or less to the point now where we can concentrate on the last little bit so that it will soon be swimmable.
There was a whale.
Yeah, exactly. That's a kind of urban miracle. And we are good at it, and we will do it even better.
Well, this idea that the things that are run well, we don't notice, even though, you know, that's the majority of what the city council does or what a specific level of government does, I think it's something worth pausing on, really just emphasizing. It's like you're saying, like, water is so important. And if Metro Vans, like, people, there have been international competitions of drinking water, which sounds like the most boring competition of taste testing ever. Like, I'll go to the wine tasting, the beer tasting, then there's the, like, municipal water tasting, and you're like, God.
Vancouver has
won it.
Having been on military bases across the country.
All right, fair.
Water in Vancouver is great.
Yeah.
It's one of the things that I really miss every time I go to a military base somewhere in Western, like in the prairies or Eastern Canada.
But like the
and
fact
of course
we can have.
The fact that several hundred Indigenous communities have boil water advisories.
Yes.
Yeah.
Let us remember.
Yeah.
And so within Metro Vancouver here, we don't have to debate do we have good enough water because it's been settled. And we can sort of move on to next levels.
In fact, you can actually take a tour of the Capilano Reservoir, which is incredible, and you should
it's
go.
It's worth doing.
And,
so
and you can
cool.
snowshoe to it in the winter, too. They do snowshoe tours to the Capilano the Reservoir as well, which is super cool.
I see you want to jump in on the set.
Can I give you a secret of the city?
Yes, please.
And you promise that no one in this room will tell you what I've just told you? After 9/11, the water engineer at the city, and she was... she was a she, and that's big at the city. She was, at the time, the most senior female in engineering. They commissioned a special test up at the reservoirs where all the drinking water for Metro Vancouver comes from because we were afraid of hazards and risk. And the assessment came back that there's so much water up there and the potential to always get water up there
that no one can do anything to ruin the water.
It's there's just so much water. You have to like add so much of something to do something.
You just can't do it. You can't do it. And remember, too, we don't use any groundwater. We're talking about one of the most precious resources, I think, in the world. And I think in the next 50 to 60 years, probably your lifetime, not mine, that it'll be a resource that will be highly valued by people not in Vancouver and not in Canada. So we need to keep this all a big secret.
I dispute that Canada thing, because I have relatives who live in Alsace, Saskatchewan, and they put a little 22 cartridge on the table and they say this is an Alsace rain gauge. Very little rain falls in much of the prairies and dunes begin to emerge. Calgary has had major drought conditions over a huge amount of time, and it is worth remembering that water is a precious resource. The first thing that I did when I was involved in politics was get involved in the Federal Liberal Party, and they brought the Calgary Nose Hill. Yes, that's the actual name of the riding. Nose Hill.
I love that there's a hill in Calgary named Nose. Yeah.
It looks like a nose.
It does.
Oh my God, I'm filled with, there's Calgarians everywhere.
And Nose Hill, Calgary Nose Hill brought this riding, this resolution to the Federal Liberal Convention that was about the non-commodification of water, and it's going to be a major issue, and it's why I come down on the weird side of the Nestle debate. But I think it is like incredibly important to value water as a resource and make sure that it maintains its status as something that is essential, a human right, because it is a human essential.
Yeah. And we'll do that. So let me give you a segue here about the reality of politics. There is $500 million worth of concrete and pumps and pipes up there in Seymour just to clean up the water, make it less dirty, apparent. No problem as far as health, but we did it anyway. $500 million. I remember the vote. It took about 15 minutes. And then we spent the next 2 hours talking about a $50,000 expenditure.
That is my favorite thing about politics.
Yeah.
It's my least favorite thing about politics.
Well, people cannot relate to $500 million, don't know what it really means. $50,000, you know what that's like. So we tend to get the trivial because people can relate to it. And that's just a reality of politics.
So Sandy, you worked in the city for a number of years.
Many.
What is election season like for somebody that works in the city? Does it matter to you guys?
Oh God, does it matter? working, something funny happens, and it normally happens about March, and we get all of these kind of strange and very small requests, and you know that it's starting to be, and we call it silly season internally at the city, and people are come and they meet you and they're all very nice to you and you get very strange requests. But I can tell you something else that you might find interesting, that the first council after the election, that's when city staff, we try to put in all the reports of things that we don't think that council really understand and that they will approve. And I remember doing that. We were trying.
Hector's in the room.
Sorry, Mr. Bremner. But I remember doing that when we tried to put in the first fake turf football field in. And it was quite contentious in those days because if you're looking at it from a universal healthcare perspective, those AstroTurf, they're bad on legs and they cost a lot of money. But we don't, in terms of the medical system. But we're working for the city, so we don't care about that.
You don't have to mow the lawn.
Yeah, so I mean, it cost $300,000. Council all looked at each other and they all put their hands up, and that was great. It got approved.
That is not where I expected that to go. But that's really neat. I think it's the role of a staff person, the role of the bureaucracy is really fascinating to me. But I guess to transition a little bit, since we were talking about sort of. We were talking before this about sort of moving towards this movement of youth and moving towards what's happening in this election. Do you guys think that this election is very unique in terms of this rezoning movement?
Oh my God, yeah, totally. This is wild.
And you went through six elections.
Yeah, yeah, and you would never talk about that. there were third rail issues, property tax, significant increase in property tax, variable property tax. not to be discussed. And the idea that you would go in and rezone existing neighborhoods that would in any way fundamentally change their scale and character, at least for the NPA, not going to happen.
And even the left wouldn't touch that rail either.
Well, it was an understanding. City Hall never goes into a neighborhood and says, hi, we're here to change you fundamentally. How would you like us to do that? The first thing they're going to ask is, what do you like about your neighborhood? How can we preserve and maintain and enhance the values and the services you already get? For candidates to, and we saw this in the civic by-election, to say, on one end, NPA, Hector, let's talk about a citywide rezoning. And on the left, let's talk about a mansion tax, variable property tax. And to see that those candidates pulled high and then fundamentally changed the dialogue that we see mm-hmm. now in this election, that is a profound, unprecedented change.
Let us be perfectly honest. The left has been a force opposed to development in the city since the anti-density movement.
Oh, come on.
No, it has. It has.
I mean, yeah, but so is the right. Everyone's opposed density.
No. But I am absolutely tired of this holier-than-thou.
Oh, no, the left doesn't have it. The left can't stand on a high horse.
Yeah, that is because there is absolutely... You know, there's a joke there, but I couldn't find it in time. But
thank God.
there is this plaque in Kitsilano that says, these are the heroes who laid down in front of the bulldozers who prevented there from being density of all things. And I want to put like some poster board around it saying, this is how we got to the problem that we have.
But those plaques, I live in Kitsilano. Those plaques are around low-rise rental buildings and co-ops. Kitsilano does have those. Like, Kitsilano still has its program. Yeah.
Kitsilano has
issues.
A lot of medium density.
When you go further to Point Grey, I agree with you. There's issues.
Like,
but
Kitts is the only neighborhood with a missing middle built form. So. Like, Kitts is the only neighborhood in Vancouver that really has a significant missing middle built form where they have that mid-rise rental builds. Anyways.
Yeah, it's hidden density in that location.
Yeah.
And I just wanted to remind you that there are other bulldozers, too. I stood in front of the bulldozer that was going to take down the roundhouse. And Alvin Nayrod, who was the head of PAVCO, the British Columbia Corporation, told me that I would never work in this province again. He was right.
Hey, well. I don't want to say that there are no times that you should. That there are no times that you shouldn't stand in front of bulldozers.
No, there is never a time you should stand in front of a bulldozer.
But
believe me. And when you do
you
it,
think that, as
don't
long as you
ever
think the driver will stop.
Yeah, don't ever elbow anybody in yellow.
God,
that's a police officer.
I swear to God, I'm not going to come out 2 days later and say wouldn't. Oh, so no.
To go back to it, for both of you, for your perspectives, I mean, I think those that are tuning into municipal politics for the first time this election, I think there's a lot of people for that. This seems like a normal conversation. The idea that maybe we should allow duplexes and triplexes and stuff. And I really want to double down on this idea of just how, like, I loved your reaction there, Gordon, about, like, you were like, never. We would never have said this before. And, like, from your entire run on council, that never would have come up.
Secondary suites was the furthest we were prepared to go. And even then, we only got to the point where we asked neighborhoods, would you think about maybe considering the possibility that we would talk about it for ultimately the rezoning that might or might not occur?
And then you were just legalizing something that was already prevalent.
Oh, well, the institutionalized hypocrisy around that was profound, and we all knew it. But to go in and do anything that would change the status, and because really zoning is about status, the status of your neighborhood, what that means to you, these are really important values to people. And so anything that would alter that RS1, that idea that you'd reached some kind of pinnacle, sometime
RS1
expectation.
Single family zoning.
Even the idea of
that's
a single family.
That's most of Vancouver, right? Like something like 80% of Vancouver is RS1.
No,
at this point.
But doesn't
no?
matter.
Okay.
It seems like a lot of it. Because that's our DNA.
Right.
Because we were a city built around the electric streetcar, we jumped over all the other previous forms of density. Apartment districts and row houses and anything that characterizes something other than being able to have your own lot with your own house. Every culture that I'm aware of has as an icon the single family house, whether it's Little House on the Prairie or Downton Abbey. That means something profound in every culture. Vancouver, from the West End to Strathcona, all single family. Streetcar neighborhoods, all single family, at least the appearance of it. That is who we are. And that is really important to people, whether they've lived here for five generations or they've recently arrived. So any politician who thinks they're going to go in and do a citywide rezoning that will change that character or scale in a way that seems to take away people's sense of place, of home, of status, they will learn very quickly that that isn't a reality that they can spend their political capital on.
And if I could, I've just written about this in this book that I was plugging, but imagine in 1928 there was over 200 kilometers of streetcar line. And what that meant is that everybody that worked, no matter what your job was, you could afford to buy a lot. And that's why even in Vancouver and different places, you see that it's not like back east where all the houses look similar, because people built what they could build at the time. But it went to Sapperton, went out to New Westminster, but everyone had the access to a single family house. And I think that was profoundly, again, in kind of the genetic makeup of
right.
who we are.
That's who we are.
Was that book that you were plugging, Walking, Connecting Health with Sustainable Transportation?
It could be.
Yes.
And indeed,
Walking,
when I wrote about
sustainable transportation.
Oh, thank you.
May I add another little reality check here to any idea that there's going to be a stop to, quote, development? It would take a politician who got in on that platform, I don't know, I'd give them half an hour, before they realized really what they were talking about is shutting down the economy. And it wouldn't be the developers they would be dealing with. It would be the unions and the construction trades. It would be all the design firms. It would be the retail market. It would be a shock in every respect, the idea that they could just shut it down somehow while we do a planning exercise. That is not going to happen.
I think somebody posted recently that we are more reliant in British Columbia as a province on construction than Alberta is on oil. And
Real estate in general.
Yeah. Real estate, yeah.
Well, I didn't even talk about real estate.
Yeah.
I just simply mentioned so much of what is in any economy is essentially the building of habitat.
Yeah. How many people
are construction workers? It's a city council's job to basically, if not facilitate it, at least allow it to occur at a rate that's acceptable to the community.
I challenge
it's
this.
About the rate. It's not whether it's going to happen.
I challenge this. I don't agree. I think that there is different economic models and different economic examples that have been proven to work around the world. I went to planning school on the Gold Coast, and I feel like...
Oh, lucky.
The Gold Coast is a lovely place, and Bond University is an excellent university, but it is too hot for me and has too suburban for my taste. It's a strip city on the east coast of Australia, and it is like extends basically from Brisbane down to the New South Wales border. The building cycle on the Gold Coast goes through the 7-year boom and bust cycle, and when I was down there, I did some academic work on the affordable housing situation in Gold Coast compared to Vancouver, and how the Gold Coast seems to go through this 7-year boom and bust cycle that has actually incentivized the development of apartment buildings as opposed to the traditional single-family units that characterize places like Robina and Mermaid Waters. Those are meaningless phrases to you, but like, it's important. I think that that kind of change can be achieved in, you know, a single city council election, because that is what happened on the Gold Coast. I think it is possible. I think it is achievable. And I think that, like, the fact that many of the candidates do not want to upend the apple cart, and one appears to want to upend the apple cart and redevelop it into condos, is, I think, a good
How can you turn
sign.
An apple cart into condos?
Well, ask Hector.
With effort.
We're not actually disagreeing very much here, Ian. We're both talking about the rate of change. There are these externalities, particularly the global economy. Anyone who was around here in 81 realizes that. And that these externalities are definitely going to have a huge impact on the economy of any place. But the job of a local government is to facilitate that process of development.
Yeah, and I'd have to say, you know, everybody on council, it's surprising. They're all wonderful people. They really do truly care. And one of the things that's really important in a city is to ensure that you have staff that have come up through the department and have a history and can provide that to council when they're asking for it. But one of the things that has just happened at council that I think is, again, we're talking about hidden density, is the idea that you can build a duplex on any single family lot. So think about that. Think what that means. That means that normally you could get 3 units, right? You get the basement suite, the main house, and a carriage house. But if you can do the same thing, you're now talking about 6 units on a single family lot. And, this is
the making room?
Making room. And it's a way of doing gentle density that is coming up to the missing middle part. But we have to start, and I think that there will be lots of room for construction with that.
This is really what this election is going to be about. If this is radical stuff, by the way, as far as the rate of change in these established neighborhoods. And I'm talking everything from Grandview Woodland to Dunbar here.
Yeah.
This is as true on the east side as it is on the
Perhaps
west.
Perhaps boundary to Belmont?
I'll go with that. Excellent.
Oh, my.
So,
also, yes.
The ramifications of this haven't become apparent yet. But if there is a mandate from the electorate by the people that get elected to council to do these kind of changes on this kind of scale, this would definitely be a new era for Vancouver.
And also, remember how changes happened really quickly. When you think in the 80s, when I started working at the city, I lived in an illegal basement suite. And when I bought a house, it had an illegal basement suite. I found out that everybody else in the planning department had illegal basement suites. We were enforcing not having them, but if you had a house in Vancouver, you had them, and we also had 2 students living with us. And that's from the 80s. But think from the 1980s when it was illegal to all of a sudden now we've made it legal. And then we've just brought in, 10 years ago we started talking about coach houses, and now not only are they legal, but we're now talking about making them strata so that you can actually own it. So that rate of change is happening faster and faster. But yeah, we have to stop being so conservative.
I mean, it seems like this is the election for that. Whether you're on the right or the left, it seems like this is the election to shake things up. And it's going to be really fascinating. We actually don't have a whole lot of time left. But I know that, Ian, you really wanted to talk about walkability, sidewalks, curb cuts, especially with Sandy's sort of background with the city.
Yeah, I know you're involved with a group called Walk Metro Vancouver, Sandy. And one of the things that I just like to vent about when I walk about Kitsilano is that there are blocks on Kitsilano that don't have sidewalks. This makes no sense to me because this should be an accessible city. Like, my brother uses a wheelchair, and that's tough to traverse when you don't have, like, you walk around Kitsilano and suddenly it's like grass, gravel, road. You're like,
so
what happened here?
So when the city builds sidewalks, how does the city do it?
Well, you've got a good point. You know, firstly, one of the things that we're going to find in the next, by 2030, 1/4 of Canadians are going to be seniors. That's a lot of people. That's why you're seeing things like people talk about plastic surgery now. You never heard that kind of stuff before. But part of it is that we've got to keep all those folks healthy. And believe me, the medical system's not going to be there for those people for that start of the baby boom. Sorry, Gordon. But part of, so what that means is we've got to do sidewalks, you've got to think about blue gyms, keeping people healthy. What we know about walking is that if you get people on sidewalks, it builds up connectivity, it's sociable, it releases oxytocin, which is the cuddle chemical if you make eye contact with someone that you don't know. And it also,
Matthew is like eyeballing all of you.
So.
But also, it's about physical health, it's about mental health. It's showing more and more that connection's important. So what happened at the city in the old days is if you were building a house, you had to provide the sidewalk in front or put a portion of the money towards the sidewalk. There are parts of the city that didn't happen. And in 2004, there was now a new policy that the city can just build sidewalk and get that to happen. Under this current council, they've really been working towards things like bikeways. The greenway that's now being talked about by another councillor was actually on the books 12 years ago. And when this council came in, they decided not to do the East Side Greenway. So that's not a new idea. But yes, we need to come back and we need to put that infrastructure in. And I certainly understand your brother's point. My partner's disabled. And we have the same concern. And also, they need to be wider. We used to think that 1.8 meters was wide. It's not anymore. It's 2.4, 2.5 meters.
And it's 1.8 meters with people's bushes and hedges kind of growing over it.
And bike locks and trees and
there was a great
traffic
picture.
Meters.
There was a great picture out of Burnaby where there was like 2 traffic poles.
That was my tweet. Yeah.
And there's one I can talk about because it got about 100 comments on price tags. Right. And that was that I talked about the elephant on Point Grey Road. Do you guys know the elephant? There's a yard. It has a really huge elephant in it. I'm serious. The guy's got an elephant in his front yard. So he had to fence the elephant in. And he took the gate for the elephant all the way up over City Boulevard right onto the sidewalk. So I went to the director of engineering, and I whined, and I whined to a couple of counselors, but nobody picked it up. And when we went back to do the Point Grey Greenway, make that part of the Seaside Greenway, they had to go and talk to the people that had the elephant. But, you know, that elephant is so symbolic that you cannot let... This is city property. The elephant was sitting on a good 2 meters of city property. You can't allow fences to happen. But that got about 100 different remarks. And actually, we were talking about our favorite elephants finally with the lady about Elmer, the safety elephant and everything. But it's really important for us to maintain City Boulevard.
It is. You've touched on something that I want to briefly mention, and that is the idea of designing around accessibility and designing around the people who require accessibility and how that impacts everyone. Curb cuts are those things that were originally designed for people who need to use wheelchairs to get off of curbs onto streets and then back onto curbs, because people should be able to use streets. Amazing.
Like, but when you come at the end of a sidewalk at a corner, the sidewalk goes down onto the street. And often it points right into the intersection.
A curb ramp.
Rather than towards like the next path.
Yeah, we call those suicide curb ramps, or we also call it engineers doing a cheap job.
Yeah, because it's easier to aim one path right into the middle of the intersection than to aim two at the where you want to go.
Right, and what you're talking about is universal accessibility, yes. And that means that no matter what your level of ability is, that you should be able to walk on the street. And moms know all about this. If you've got a buggy and you're trying to move a buggy or a wheelchair, and you're pushing and you've got a dog attached to it, you really need to have stuff clear, and you know more about the city than most people.
And those are the ancillary effects of designing around people who require those kinds of innovations in design. And it is incredible. Like, I am a bike courier at the moment, and I use those.
Everyone's
illegally.
Favorite person in downtown Vancouver.
You know what? You know what?
I know you have a
the
job to do.
The downtown economy absolutely requires us to exist. So, like, let's leave that aside and we can discuss that later. But, so many people who are dragging luggage around, who are moving their baby buggies around, who are roller skating or
use the
whatever.
Bike lane.
Yeah. Well, you know... Sometimes there is a choice between what is legal and what is safe. So unless you want me to end up as one of the poor schmucks who get schmucked by a delivery truck,
yeah. I'm talking about the roller skating.
No, I understand. Please don't make them use the bike lane.
All right. I think that's anyway, such a key component, is how people get around and making sure that people can get around. And
but the point I'm trying to make is that you need to design around the... maximum accessibility for everyone, because there are, one, positive ancillary effects for so many people, and two, you have to design around the veil of ignorance. It's John Rawls. And while I can't get into all of that because we're running out of
time. We have like 3 minutes left.
Actually, I think we're about like 11 minutes over
way over time.
Yes. But,
so
sidewalks are great for the economy.
Absolutely.
Are fantastic for the economy.
So
a whole other lecture.
So we like to end every episode of the podcast on a Vancouverada. One of the things that we would like to do with this Vancouverada is talk about the Burrard Bridge bike lane, but not the current one, because the current one, which I've used and everyone's used and is wonderful and is heavily used, wasn't the first time that there was a Burrard Bridge bike lane. Isn't that the case there, Gordon?
You betcha. In 1996, I remember it well.
And so you guys put in, as the city council, you put in a trial bike lane.
I'm going to take personal responsibility for this.
And it's funny because it's so successful today.
Yeah, and it was a total disaster.
And in 96 when you did the trial.
Yeah, absolutely. Too quickly done, not thought through, no real support from engineering to do it. Very minor support on council. I just managed to get one vote. And the reason was is we had a capital plan to... upgrade the Burrard Bridge. And we were going to build buttresses flying out from the sides in order to provide for wider sidewalks. My thought was we could save a hell of a lot of money if we simply took a lane. At least why don't we try? Managed to get that through, as I say, total disaster. No one was really prepared for it. And, little known fact, it was just the beginning of the era of the cell phone. So for the affluent people on the west side who were caught in that traffic, to their surprise, they pulled out their phones and called the mayor's office.
Or CKW.
Stuck in traffic.
It was, yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Or they called
CKW.
Because
it wasn't illegal to call the mayor's office while you were driving then.
Absolutely right.
And I remember talk radio was in flames.
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely.
Absolutely right. So within a matter of hours, that project was over. But here's the irony of it. Because at that point, we weren't going to proceed with any other major capital project, it really allowed us to do the cheapest and easiest thing, which was to create this network of bikeways by using the side residential streets.
You're talking like Ontario.
That's you're right. Responsible for the Ontario.
10th Avenue, Adanac, et cetera, right?
Yeah, yeah. The council was prepared to go along with that. It was also integrated into some of the early vision plans for cycling. But by building up a constituency over time, it then allowed us to take these eventual steps to do the kind of network we see today. Might not have happened if we hadn't gone through that. I don't know. Probably would have occurred in some way. But I would like to think that even that, the failure of that 96 bike lane ultimately did lead to the progress that we've made today.
Well, maybe not baby steps, but maybe there were training wheels. I think that it has led to an incredible bike network in the city, one that Seattle has actually, The Stranger recently published an article saying, how does Vancouver get bike lanes? How did they do it? And apparently the answer is sitting right next to me. So thank you, Gordon, for everything that you and in your council have done in order to promote biking.
Thanks, Ian.
It every day.
I don't quite deserve that, but I'm going to go with it.
Even those days that I drive to work, even though I'm biker.
Gordon and Sandy, before we let you go, tell everyone who's here and who will be listening later where they can find Price Tags, where they can find you on the internet.
Well, I'm glad to say if you just Google Price Tags, it's going to pop up. PriceTags.ca. And yeah, we're going to be back to you guys. And for those of you who think Price Tags is something worth keeping, worth expanding, we'll be asking for your support on that.
Check out their eventual Patreon at... I don't know. Insert later.
I don't know
we'll
what that was.
Yeah,
we'll figure that out.
And are you on Twitter doing anything else? Where can people find Walk Metro Vancouver?
You can find us on Twitter under Walk Metro Van, and also we have a website at walkmetrovan.ca. And we actually are for the region, not just for the city.
The whole metro, you might say.
The whole metro. And
a GVRD.
Even. Yeah. We're a nonprofit society, and we have directors that are from Metro Van and health departments, cities, and also the universities.
Also, a great opportunity for us to thank you guys because really, you're broadening the conversation. More importantly, just simply by keeping a list, that's invaluable. Thank you for your contribution, and we'll be, of course, continuing to tune in.
And thank you for making this so much fun.
Thank you very much,
Sandy James and Gordon Price, everyone.
Thanks, guys.
And I'd love to thank everybody for coming out. It's wild and amazing whenever we have a moment to sit down with all of you and be able to say, you know, and you thank us for the work that we do. And it's unbelievably touching. All of us are always amazed that people listen to us just talk at a microphone. What we're going to do now is we've got about 10 more minutes before I think a DJ is going to come on. I think there's some music going to be played. People are welcome to stick around, hang out. Also, upstairs is open at Doolin's, depending on what you'd prefer. And feel free to get at us with your hot takes after we're done this.
We totally meant to say you could tweet us tonight at #CanbyReportLive, but we didn't.
We 100% did not.
Instead, you were just tweeting at CanbyReport, which was great. Thank you all for coming. Yay. Keep supporting us on Patreon. Keep, you know, following us on Facebook and Twitter.
Reviews. 5-star reviews on iTunes, please.
All right. Well, thank you very much. And I think that's the end of the podcast.
Woo! 93 days to go, everyone. We can get through this. Good night.